This is Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news and intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversations. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the management and staff of Guardian Radio.
Good evening again, Bahamas. It's March again, and this is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. We have here in the studio myself, Bahamian urologist Dr. Gregory Pinto, and as always, my co-host, Bahamian general surgeon and surgical oncologist Dr. Wesley Francis. And we're very pleased to have in the studio as well, Bahamian gastroenterologist Dr. Gemma Roll. Welcome to you, Dr. Gemma Roll, and Dr. Wesley Francis.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
Good evening, Bahamas, and welcome, Dr. Roll.
So this is an interactive show. There are no silly questions. Anything related to your colon, your digestive system, we have the expert in the house. You can call us at 323-6232 or 325-4316 or 326-4259. So worldwide, colon cancer is the second highest incidence for men and women of all cancers. It's a disturbing trend where younger persons, particularly under the age of 50, are now representing about 20% of all colorectal cases. And that's very, very surprising, and we're going to talk to Dr. Gemma Roll why she thinks that's happening. But in the 1950s, it was almost unheard of to find someone less than 50 to have colorectal cancer, where now as many as 20% are unfortunately afflicted with that horrible disease that unfortunately, as it has progressed a lot earlier when you're younger, a lot of patients are in their prime of their life and they're succumbing to colorectal cancer. What are your ideas, Dr. Gemma Roll? Why are we seeing younger and younger persons getting colorectal cancer? Is it genetic mutations? Is it hereditary syndromes? Is it our diet? Is it our environment?
I think for the most part, it's going to be diet and environment, right? It's predominantly the non-modifiable risk factors. The modifiable risk factors are diet, rich in red meat, processed foods, and less fruits and vegetables that the colon likes to have. Changes in our microbiome, comorbid conditions, obesity, lack of exercise. So those are the main reasons that we're perhaps seeing colon cancer earlier. And then when we speak about genetics, you know, there's syndromes that either run in runs in families, or colon cancer itself being a risk factor.
Okay, I'll just talk on a personal note. I had to actually do general surgery more than 15 years ago before I became a urologist. So I had to rotate through colorectal service. So I had to learn how to do colectomies and stomas and colonoscopies. And I think it was at that point I reaffirmed that I'd rather deal with urine the rest of my life than to deal with stool. So I would never really have a joy in being a general surgeon or colorectal surgeon or surgical oncologist. That's why I'll leave it to Dr. Francis. Dr. Francis, I know that most of the colorectal cancers in this country, whether it's in the public service or the private service, are going to come through your hands. What trends are you seeing locally in terms of the numbers of colorectal cancers and in terms of the actual stage in which they present, both publicly and privately?
Well, I mean, for colon, we are seeing this trend of younger patients. And I mean, year on year, you're starting to see much younger patients in their 40s presenting with colon cancer. And when they do present, though, it's sometimes very late. And, you know, one of the things that we always say is that colorectal cancer is preventable. And it is the one cancer that you can totally prevent. But sadly, for younger patients, they tend to be outside of the screening age. And the screening age is around, it's 45. So we're seeing patients sometimes in their 30s, sometimes in, you know, below 45. And that poses a problem. And so, but when you see them, it's generally late. And also, you know, in our population, patients tend to have symptoms that they, you know, attribute to gas and all of that. And so it gets overlooked. And then, you know, change in bowel habits. And the one specific thing that I want Dr. Roll to comment on is, you know, sometimes we see young patients who have bleeding per rectum. And, you know, it's attributed to hemorrhoids. And often our own colleagues continue to treat them for hemorrhoids, and then they turn out to end up having colon cancer. So Dr. Roll, in your practice, when you see somebody coming with bleeding mm-hmm. per rectum, what is your process? What do you advise them?
So first of all, rectal bleeding is never normal. Yes, there are differentials for rectal bleeding. It can be caused by things other than colon cancer or rectal cancer or colon polyps. However, you really won't know for sure unless you do a colonoscopy, okay? You can have bleeding once. You could have bled last year. And this can be your one sentinel event warning you that something is really wrong. So when patients come to me with rectal bleeding, I offer them a colonoscopy, okay? I recommend a colonoscopy. I suggest a colonoscopy. If there is an aversion, you never want to force anyone to do something that they don't want to do, but my job is to equip persons with all the information to make an informed decision. But should they not opt to do a colonoscopy, then you treat symptoms. But my recommendation will always be to have a colonoscopy. And that's one of the benefits of being an interventionalist, a gastroenterologist, a proceduralist, is because I can go in and I can look. I can confirm a diagnosis. It's a beautiful thing. I don't have to play guessing games.
Right.
Yeah.
So what about when people come to you, and I guess we're talking about symptoms, and so one of the symptoms, especially on left-sided colon cancer, we're talking about bleeding per rectum, and we know that that's always abnormal, and you should get it fully investigated. What about this change in bowel habits? I mean, sometimes people, report one day constipated, the next day they're having diarrhea, or just gassy feeling. What's your approach to those patients? Mm-hmm.
So the approach is going to be based on their age. If you are 45 years or older, we start off with, well, have you been screened for colon cancer? If you know for a fact that you don't have colon cancer, you've been screened because you've crossed that threshold of 45 years old, then we can talk about why you're not having a bowel movement every day, right? The approach is going to be based on where they fall on that age. And so for those who are younger than 45 years old, we talk about their risk factors for colon cancer. And if they meet the criteria to be screened early, we do that. And then we kind of backtrack and talk about why you don't have the ideal bowel movement for you, or why there has been a change.
Is there a difference between, because we know the colon, your right side and the left side, mm-hmm. and then the piece in the middle. Is there a difference in the way they present to you?
I textbook would say that a left-sided lesion or a distal lesion, rectal lesion, you may have thin stools, okay, because the stool comes out narrow. Mm-hmm. Persons with left-sided disease or distal disease could present with diarrhea, right? Increased bowel movements.
What about the actual color of the blood? You're more likely to have brighter red blood versus the dark digested Molina stool from the right-sided colon cancer?
So the right-sided colon lesions, which would be at the beginning of the colon, would have a more darker red, maroon-colored stools. But that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. You can have bright red bleeding from any point in the colon. The textbook would say that, yes,
or a small bowel or from the stomach or from the esophagus. So you might even need an upper GI scope.
Right. So higher up in the digestive tract, the stomach, the small bowel, you'd have black stool, black like the color that my hair used to be, right?
And it usually has that pungent odor as well.
Pungent odor. It's going to be more slick. Or some patients can have solid stools that are black. So you probably want to investigate higher up.
So the take-home message for all of the listeners is you have to examine your stool every day.
Examine your stool.
You got to look back.
I cannot recall a time when I never did. I mean, it's a daily thing.
It's your own. Look back.
Yeah, you
and
have
then,
to.
I've seen many disturbing trends. A lot of persons, as you say, they feel this gassy feeling. They change in bowel habits. They ignore it. But a lot of patients, I'll ask them, do you have any constipation? And they'll say, no. Then you delve a little bit further. And then they find out, the last 3 years, they take a Dalkalex every single day.
Yes. Or they're straining. Yes. Or they have to do maneuvers to have a bowel movement.
Or enema every 2-3 days. And they think that becomes their norm. And they don't realize that they might be missing something early that's sinister going on, and then it just progresses to late. Right. Another disturbing strand, and this form, we always talk about proactive, being preventative in terms of medicine, and also treating the root cause of anything. So a lot of persons taking the throw hand, they'll find out they have iron deficiency anemia. They're taking the iron supplements to treat that, not even trying to determine. And a lot of even our fellow physicians are guilty of that. Mm-hmm. Why do they have the iron deficiency anemia?
Right.
That might be colon cancer right there. Then they go on to take the iron supplementation, which they know will cause some amount of constipation. So they chuck up the iron deficiency to the lack of iron. They chalk up the constipation to taking the iron.
And a lot of stool dark.
Yeah, and a lot of the colon cancer is missed because of that.
Right. Yeah.
So anytime you have iron deficiency anemia, what should someone go through in terms of workup?
So certainly anemia of any kind, right? And then there's a big handful of patients who would say that they've always been anemic since I was a child, or they say that, it runs in my family because a parent had anemia. A low blood count. So anemia is when you have lower than normal blood count. You can have a lower than normal blood count because you're losing blood, and this is what we're looking for when we're considering colon cancer or other malignancies, or you're just not making enough blood, or you're destroying your blood. So when you have anemia of any kind, you want to know, which category you fall in. And so there is a workup. You can be tested for actual iron deficiency, vitamin B12 deficiency, folate deficiency, and then a few other things, because anemia can be the presentation of multiple myeloma, for example. So depending on your other parameters, your other tests, there would be a more streamlined workup for that.
No, so we talk about no one really needs to be dying of colon cancer. That's correct. Does every polyp that you may encounter in doing a colonoscopy have the potential to become malignant? Are there some benign polyps that, despite their size, will always be benign?
Good question. So there are a few types of polyps. First of all, when we find any polyp, which is just a growth in the colon, essentially, we remove it. It's tested. There are some polyps that will never grow into a cancer. You can kind of tell which ones they are because of the features, but we still remove them anyway. What we're looking for when we screen for colon cancer and colon polyps are these polyps called adenomas. So adenomas are abnormalities that derive from glands, glandular tissue that a lot of our organs are lined with. So it's the adenoma that we're looking for. And then there's different degrees or there's different changes that occur in these adenomas that put us closer to cancer. So terms like sessile serrated, villous adenoma, high-grade dysplasia. These are the things that we're looking for the pathologist to tell us that will prognosticate for the patient or put them in a category of what risk they're at and when should we repeat a colonoscopy. So polyps should be followed up. If your doctor told you that you have polyps, you kind of want to know what kind, and your doctor should also be telling you when your colonoscopy needs to be repeated. I found that a lot of patients would take away from their colonoscopy that my doctor said that my polyps were benign. So for the most part, they're going to be benign. But it tells us what your risk is. So yes, you had benign polyps, but they need to be surveilled. You need to repeat your colonoscopy after a certain time.
So essentially, a colonoscopy can be both diagnostic and therapeutic and preventative.
Preventative, yes. Which is why, you know, in an unbiased fashion, I believe, because if you're truly informed, you would agree that colonoscopy is the best form of screening for colon cancer, because it's the only screening tool of a cancer that's preventable, correct? Wesley, do you know any other one?
Yes, right.
We're preventing colon cancer with a colonoscopy.
There are select individuals, unfortunately, because of genetic hereditary syndromes, genetic mutations, whether it's Lynch syndrome. Or FAP.
Familial, 100% guaranteed to get colon cancer
polyposis,
with FAP.
Gardner syndrome, Turcotte syndrome.
Yes.
Can we really say we can prevent those persons from getting, we can be very diligent in picking it up, but some people, no matter what, you'll get colonoscopies very, very routinely. That's where the next question goes to Dr. Francis. For patients who have FAP, which is familial adenomatous polyposis, almost inevitably you're going to get colon cancer. Mm-hmm. Just as we've spoken many times in the past about persons, for one reason or the other, are genetically predetermined to get breast cancer, we do prophylactic mastectomies. What is the role for actually doing a prophylactic total colectomy for those patients who have FAP or other syndromes where they have an uncle, they have a brother, they have a sister, they have a dad, they have a mom who all had colon cancer, particularly at an early age?
So FAP, as you said, familial adenomatous polyposis, is a condition where you genetically have or predisposed to developing polyps, which over time, those polyps then go on to become cancers. Those polyps develop at a very early age. And it usually runs in families. And so, you know, those patients tend to do present with some symptoms at times because there are different variants of FAP. There's the variants where people have over 1,000 polyps. There's others where they have hundreds of polyps. And then there's a variant where they don't have many. But the one thing about those families is that you know that there's a family history. So if you have a family history of colon cancer and you know that you have a brother or a sister, uncle who's had it at an early age, you may be a part of that family. And we have several families out there who we've actually done what we call prophylactic colectomies. And when I mean prophylactic, you're still treating them for the polyps that they have, but before they develop colon cancer. And sometimes you have to remove the entire colon. You remove the colon and they live and they do well. The rest of the intestines adapt. And they can go on to live a normal life. But you prevent them from actually developing colon cancer because you know that they will. And so, again, it's important to know your family history and important to pay attention to your body and especially what goes on in your GI tract. One of the things that I want to ask Dr. Roll is, oh, we got a call?
Good evening. This is Urologist Speaks.
Good evening, man. Listen, everybody's speaking so well tonight. I just wonder if I should just listen instead of calling.
Oh, I'm glad you did call in.
Yeah, the rectal bleeding, I understand, requires colonoscopy, or the alternative would be to treat the symptoms, from what I'm learning. And I want to thank you, Dr. Pinto, for this educational forum that you are putting together every Wednesday.
My pleasure.
Okay. I think you may never be able to appreciate and compare the level of listening and how much it's helping people just to get a hold of their own health. So I think it's important for us to compare, you know, what you're saying and what we are eating and how our bowel movement is affecting probably our whole entire body. So keep doing what
you're
doing.
Excellent points. Thank you.
Yes, I really do appreciate what you're doing. But could you tell me something? This adenomas polyps that could become cancerous if left untreated. You say there's about 100 of them in our colon?
No, that's only in hereditary syndromes we were talking about.
That's in the FAP. Those are the patients who have a genetic predisposition. But then there are others who we call them sporadic, where it develops within in patients who don't have that. And you can develop these polyps. And over time, and I'll let Dr. Roll talk about that, and why is it important to screen for these?
Right. So you understand that this hundreds or 1,000 polyps in a patient is in a syndrome called FAP, right? That's not the average risk person. So the average risk for colon cancer person gets their colonoscopy at 45. We're looking for adenomas. Adenomas are the type of polyps that grow into a cancer. You can have one. And that one polyp can grow into a cancer, perhaps over a few years or so, depending on what type of adenoma it is. So we're not going to leave a polyp inside. If we find it, we're going to remove it. Removing that polyp tells us that, hey, we need to repeat this colonoscopy in 5 years to look for more polyps, 3 years to look for more polyps. Of course, depending on how many adenomas a patient had, how advanced the adenoma is, what size it was. So there's an algorithm that we follow. But if you do your colonoscopy and your average risk, meaning you do not have a family history, a first-degree relative with colon cancer or two second-degree relatives with colon cancer or an advanced polyp, you repeat your colonoscopy in 10 years. If you have a family history, you repeat that in 5 years, even though your colonoscopy was normal. So back to the adenoma, find any polyp, we remove it. If your doctor tells you you had a polyp, you need to know when you're repeating your colonoscopy.
May I ask another question?
Mm-hmm.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, go
yes,
ahead.
Yes, good. How could we, through our diet, just flush out these adenomas polyps, probably by eating properly, or is that impossible to do? They're going to come up anyway.
How can we prevent them with dietary? What dietary advice?
So once you're growing a polyp, it has to be removed. There's no flushing on your own. There's no getting rid of it on your own through your diet. How can you prevent the formation of adenomas? We got to talk about the risk factors for colon cancer on the whole. Colon cancers are derived from these adenomas. So you have risk factors that you can do something about and those that you can't.
I know very well about them all. Thank you so very much.
Okay, very
Dr.
good.
Pinto, I appreciate you, my brother.
Thank you for my call, my brother. Good night. So we talk about why are we as a nation at such high risk? Obviously, we'll talk just the males. We don't pay attention to our bodies. We're the last ones to seek any kind of help until it's at the nth degree. We talk about our diet, our sedentary lifestyle. We talk about the high alcohol consumption. We've spoken about that, about modifiable risk factors and alcohol being a modifiable risk factor. Mm-hmm. And even for colon cancer, increased alcohol consumption. We're a country that consumes a lot of alcohol.
We do.
Has maybe a 1.2, 1.5 times greater risk of developing colon cancer. We talk about our diet in terms of we love our red meat. We love our processed foods. We love the bacon, the sausages.
Hot dog.
Our hams,
yeah.
Yes. What else can we do to reduce our risks? Obviously, we want to talk about fiber. A lot of even younger persons, mm-hmm. when does the risk really start? Does it start from our teenage years, where obviously we're developing the habits of eating healthy, et cetera, but if we're eating unhealthy as a younger person, is that in itself putting us at a higher risk as well?
Perhaps, yeah. It's an overtime thing. And then you can combine your genetic risks with your environment, you know.
Folate is also, a low folate intake also can put us at risk.
Right. And vitamin D, actually, you know, there was a meta-analysis actually on vitamin D. I mean, vitamin D, though, is one of the most common vitamin deficiencies. Yeah. So, you know, I think there was a study done on patients being diagnosed with colon cancer, and probably all of them had low vitamin D, but yeah. a lot of people have vitamin D deficiency, yeah. right? So, so diets that are low in the fiber, not enough fruits, vegetables, and I think you had asked something about how we cook the meat.
Yes.
So there's the char, right? When you grill foods, that black char.
Shouldn't be barbecuing every weekend.
Well, the thing is, there is a link for sure with that meat and gastric CA. And
smoked meats. Yeah.
Smoked meats. So certainly, you know, gastric CA is adenomatous as well. So that would apply for the colon.
I mean, there are many Bahamians that have bacon every single morning for breakfast.
Yeah, and processed meats, steamed sausage, corned beef and grits, you know.
That's the mainstay of the Bahamian diet.
It is.
It's hard to change that.
And fruits and vegetables are expensive.
Yeah. So, Dr. Will, just a question, because, I mean, I know a lot of people that are out there listening. We say that we can prevent colon cancer by doing a colonoscopy. For our audience, mm-hmm. let's go back to the basic. What is a colonoscopy?
Oh, wow.
And how do I get it? And what's the preparation?
Yeah.
And is it a bad thing and
so
getting it?
Colonoscopy is this really cool thing that I get to perform on patients all the time, right? So it's a camera. It's a camera that's the shape of a tube. It's a tube that goes into the rectum. So you're laying on your side. This tube goes into the rectum and it follows your large intestine.
Am I awake when you do this?
So the thing is, it's such an easy procedure to have done that you could be awake if you wanted to be, but you'd want to be comfortable. Yeah. There's some anxiety associated with knowing that someone's pushing a foreign object into your rectum and into your body.
So it's conscious sedation, really.
So conscious sedation, you can breathe on your own, you can move around, you may not have much recollection of what occurs. So you kind of want to be, you want to take the edge off with a sedative. So you're essentially asleep for the procedure, you're breathing on your own, you don't have to be placed on a ventilator or you know, we don't have to breathe for you. It takes about 20 minutes, sometimes a lot less, and sometimes some patients require a bit more time to do a colonoscopy. But we're pushing this tube into the abdomen. It goes up, across, and down the other side. And as we withdraw the tube, we're essentially looking. We're looking for any abnormalities that can be sampled or removed. And through the channels of this scope, we can pass accessories or tools. We can cut polyps out, we can burn, we can inject, and of course we can take pictures along the way. And then once we pull the tube out, you know, you're no longer getting the medication. You kind of wake up right away and you know what your results are as soon as the procedure is done. I think that the hardest part for the patient with the colonoscopy is going to be the bowel prep. So you may read up about several ways that you can do a bowel preparation, but it is simply where you're drinking clear liquids for an entire day, the day before the procedure, and then you drink this large volume laxative. My preference is for the patient to drink a gallon. They can split the gallon in half. They can drink one half in the evening and one half about 4 hours prior to the procedure. And that would essentially give you diarrhea. And what you want to see is water passing out of your rectum afterwards. This is crucial and this is important that you want to have.
One question that I think pertains to a lot of persons out there, and that's the trend of a lot of persons taking Ozempic, and that it slows the transit of everything that we eat. How does that affect us in terms of getting an adequate bowel prep?
Right.
Do you advise someone not to? Well, first of all, just from the anesthesia point of view, in you having someone with conscious sedation, you don't want them to regurgitate. You want them to aspirate.
Right.
You want them to avoid Ozempic, and sometimes even for a month, and then you want them to have a prolonged liquid diet, even if you're not even having any surgery.
Well, for persons on medications like the Ozempic, Mounjaro, et cetera, the recommendation that we have is that you hold your dose 7 days prior. So if you're on the weekly dose, just hold the dose the week before the procedure. And that is, for the most part, because of anesthesia. The fear is that there will be some residual liquid still in the stomach and the risk of aspiration. In my experience thus far, for those that have admitted that they're on Ozempic, right, at the time of preparation for colonoscopy, I have not found that they are less prepped, not as clean as they otherwise would
and
have been.
And prep is all important because if you're not adequately
how
prepped,
do we see?
You're going to have to abandon and then come back and go through the process again.
Well, the thing is, and I think that I could speak for all GIs, we tend not to. We push through and we just sit there and try to wash and suction up what we can. We try to push through poop that we can. You know, there is a risk element there if, you know, there's too much poop. Right? You don't want to push your way without being able to really see. But on the side of you having a colonoscopy, you want to be as clean as possible. Believe it or not, poop sticks to abnormalities, right?
Yeah.
So sometimes, Wesley, when you're flushing, you know, you flush away the stool and then up rises this big juicy polyp that was sitting under stool.
You couldn't see it, right?
So much as I'd like to be friends with my patients and give them small volume preps and have them enjoy it, I think I would be doing them a disservice, not really trying to be as aggressive and as possible with the bowel prep from the beginning.
We have a call?
Yes. Good evening. This is Urologist Speaks.
Good afternoon.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good evening.
I have a situation, but I want to speak with Dr. Pinto privately. How is that possible?
I'll just let you get my contact through the producer.
Hello?
Yeah. You can just call back and the producer can give you my contact number.
Okay.
All right. So when we're talking about prep, and you want to keep hydrated, and the go-to is Gatorade. You don't want to have red Gatorade because everything's going to look red and you're going to scare the hell out of your gastroenterologist.
Red Gatorade, Kool-Aid, Popsicle, Jell-O, you want to avoid all red substances. It does look like blood in the colon. In fact, even watermelon. But you shouldn't be drinking, you shouldn't be eating watermelon for days prior to your procedure.
Or even Kool-Aid, no red Kool-Aid.
Yeah, but drinking liquids is very important. It kind of preps the bowel for that large volume prep at the end of the day before the procedure. So you want to be drinking these liquids throughout the day.
So I just want to talk a little bit about the advances that are going on in terms of understanding colorectal cancer, in terms of risk factors. We talk about the gut microbiome, and it being closely related to increased risk for colorectal cancer. How is it related? We talk about what exactly is a microbiome.
So the microbiome is actually considered to be a whole other organ system, right? We have the skeletal system, the digestive system, the cardiovascular, and then you have your microbiome. From the top of your head to the bottom of your feet, I mean, we have bacteria or microbes that live symbiotically with us. And so the microbiome in the gut decreases inflammation. So it's inflammation that causes cancer, right? Or one of the things that causes cancer. And so when you have your microbiome in your gut...
Which involves fungi, it involves bacteria, it involves viruses.
From the birth canal, from when you were born, playing in the sandbox, being breastfed, we are building up our microbiome. And speaking of which, when you have a diarrheal illness, when you have antibiotics, you can lose up to a third of your microbiome and there can be a shift.
So I want you to repeat that because, you know, a lot of people, they get a little cold or a flu, which is usually viral, and they want antibiotics. How does the indiscriminate use of antibiotics that we've been seeing affect your microbiome?
Oh, my goodness. So antibiotics are to treat bacteria, it's to get rid of bacteria. So what we're aiming for is to get rid of the bad bacteria, but we actually get rid of good bacteria that mm-hmm. lives with us from birth. So we shouldn't be treating all sniffles with antibiotics. That's a whole other topic.
Yeah.
But what you can do, if you must be on antibiotics, you should take probiotics, not just the yogurt. I think Activia did a good job with their marketing campaign because when you think probiotics, a lot of people just think the yogurt. We're talking about actual probiotics that you can either get over the counter. I really like the prescription grade probiotics. But probiotics should really be something that we consider as like a vitamin that you take along with you mm-hmm. know you take along with your multivitamin because the gut flora does a lot of things.
Yeah, so it has a role with it's structural, it's protective, it's metabolic, it's involved in nutrient and mineral absorption as
absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely.
So how it links to colorectal cancer, and that's in many ways, gut microbiome can lead to inflammation, which can lead to tissue injury and colorectal cancer. It can affect the immune system, which can lead to tumor progression and affect how well mm-hmm. cancer treatments work. Gut microbiome, a lot of studies have actually shown conclusively, can be used to detect colorectal cancer in itself and even the risk of us developing colorectal cancer before it occurs. So we look at certain bacteria in the gut that can be used to identify people with colorectal cancer. I mean, that'll be monumental. Another way of screening for colorectal cancer, minimally invasive. And then even in treatment.
She ain't buying that one.
Yes, she's not buying that one.
I mean, which
would... It also could tell how well we'll deal in terms of chemotherapy as well. We have another call coming in. This is Urologist Seeks. Good evening.
Good evening, Dr. Pinto, Dr. Francis, and Dr. Roll. It's Des Mangles calling all the way from Georgia.
Hey, Des Mangles, what's happening, Richardson?
I'm good. In terms of the colonoscopy and the findings that you could find during the process, what other abnormalities you could find and how concerned as the provider, how concerned you should be, and the steps which you would take to make sure that the patient finds and the care that would need to ensure that they receive the proper management. If other than the adenomas or the colon cancer, what other findings we could find during the colonoscopy?
Oh, that's a good question. So we find diverticulosis all the time. Is this what you're referring to? So diverticulosis is a benign condition of the bowel. We see this mostly in older people, but a lot of young people have diverticulosis mm-hmm. as well. It is a benign condition, doesn't cause cancer. What we see are outpouchings of the lining of the colon, so it looks like these little pockets are not true holes in the colon. You can have stool impacted in there. There can be complications such as diverticulitis when they become infected or inflamed, or they can bleed. It's one of the most common causes of painless rectal bleeding in the elderly population. So we can find diverticulosis. The recommendation is to be on a high-fiber diet. Some patients require actual fiber supplements, like they take a medication. So we could also find internal hemorrhoids. The hemorrhoids that most patients perhaps are familiar with are ones that are external, because you can feel them, you can see them. But there are internal hemorrhoids as well. Other disease conditions of the bowel would be inflammatory bowel disease. That's Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, which, by the way, is a risk factor for colon cancer. So after about 10 years of having inflammatory bowel disease, you are at a very high risk for colon cancer and should be screened quite often, every year or two or so. And then, you know, there is some other stuff in the colon that we can find that are not so common or rare. But at the end of the day, after colonoscopy, almost all of my reports state fiber-rich diet or high-fiber diet.
So we were talking about gut microbiome. We're talking about good and bad bacteria. Let me just extrapolate. We're not talking directly about colorectal cancer, but we're talking about, we've spoken about this before, the vast majority of individuals in this country, they'll have acid reflux symptoms. They have this burning in their chest, they have acid taste in their mouth, burning in their gut, in their epigastrium. All they'll do is reach for
Dica.
They'll reach for their Tums. They'll reach for their Losec, their Nexium. And a lot of them, they're on it for years and years and years. Talk a little bit about H. pylori. Talk about the breathalyzer test and what H. pylori eradication can do in terms of just triple antibiotics for 10 weeks or 2 weeks that can eradicate all of these symptoms instead of just treating the symptoms. As we always say, let's treat the root cause. What is H. pylori, and what's the importance of H. pylori eradication for persons who have these symptoms?
So H. pylori, Helicobacter pylori, is a bacteria. It's a special bacteria that it's very common in developing countries, very common in the Bahamas. It lives in the stomach. It's an unusual type of bacteria because the purpose of the stomach is to produce acid. So when we have contaminated food or bacteria hits the stomach, that's the beauty of the stomach, is that the acid can kill bacteria, but not this one. It buries its way into the lining of the colon, lining of the stomach, and it forms this gas or this coating around it called urea. And so what it does is it just wreaks its havoc by causing a lot of inflammation. It changes your DNA to put you at risk for stomach cancer. It just causes a lot of inflammation that, again, inflammation causes cancer. So when we find it, we treat it, whether or not you think it's any symptoms, because of that risk factor for stomach cancer. And I do believe that it is a risk factor for colon cancer as well. Mm-hmm. Okay. A lot of the patients that I refer for stomach cancer for resection, almost all of them have H. pylori. I mean, Wesley can speak more about that, but almost everyone that's diagnosed with a stomach cancer has H. pylori there.
And how do you test for H. pylori?
So there's various forms of testing. You can do an endoscopy. Endoscopy is preferred when you want to make sure that this H. pylori hasn't already caused some damage, like intestinal metaplasia, dysplasia, or even cancer. And then you want to assess for other things with endoscopy. And at the same time, you can take a biopsy in the stomach, and you're actually looking for the little bugs in the lining of the stomach on the specimen. You can also test by a breath test. Like I said, you have this bacteria produces urea. So when we're doing a breath test, we are measuring how much urea you're breathing out. or coming out of your stomach. So you can do it by the breath test. You can do a stool test. They look in the stool for the bug. There is a blood test that pretty much should only be utilized in patients who have not been diagnosed or treated before for H. pylori with the blood test. So it's really a stool test, a breath test, or an endoscopy.
So essentially, certain persons who have all of these symptoms of GERD, of reflux, if they take this H. pylori test and are treated just with antibiotics, specific antibiotics, they can eradicate the symptoms. They can change their life considerably without just overdoing it with the dike of the Tums, anticipating feeling unwell after they have every meal.
Now, I must say, for all of those that are listening this evening, all stomach pain, abdominal discomfort, indigestion, discomfort after meals, discomfort in the morning is not reflux. Acid reflux is burning or pain in the chest and beyond, going upwards as a result of acid refluxing into the esophagus. So if you have belly pain, if you have upper abdominal pain, discomfort, bad feelings after meals, getting full quickly, burping a lot, that's not reflux. This is indigestion or something we call dyspepsia. Now, there is some controversy with eradicating H. pylori and possible worsening of reflux, but I think that's at the level of the experts going back and forth, right? Mm-hmm. Because there is, you know, a possibility that, yes, acid reflux can worsen. However, we must treat H. pylori once we find it. And guess what? When we treat it, we must confirm that it's eradicated.
Yeah. And it can come back.
So, or you may not have responded to the therapy the first time. So there is an 80 to 85% response rate. We do not readily test for, we don't readily test for sensitivity. What's the word I'm looking for? Resistance. So in the U.S., they recently changed their guidelines last year where the first line therapy are these different antibiotics that we don't really have here. So we are still going on the primary recommendation of the olden times, right? Which I think for the
which
most
is very
part,
effective, yeah.
Yeah, very effective. Yeah. You'll have your handful of patients that you have to use salvage therapy or switch up the therapy. But the first line treatment is going to be two antibiotics and a medication like Nexium twice a day for 14 days. And at the same time, you must be on probiotics.
So no one should be on Nexium for years?
No. Nexium is not intended for use forever. Now, there are some patients that may require it. These patients that have been diagnosed with something called Barrett's esophagus, because even without having symptoms of acid reflux, we have to suppress the acid because they have a condition that puts them at risk for esophageal cancer. So they must be on Nexium. But no, Nexium is not meant to be on forever.
Well, this next question I have for Dr. Francis as a general surgeon, anatomically, we can have abnormalities such as hiatal hernia. Maybe you can describe that to our viewers. Previously, decades and decades ago, the mainstay of hiatal hernia was actually surgical repair. How do we deal with hiatal hernias now, and what are the symptoms of hiatal hernia?
Well, hiatal hernia, basically, any hernia is a protrusion of contents through an opening. And so you basically have a barrier between that separates the chest and the abdomen. That's the diaphragm. And the diaphragm has holes that allow the esophagus to go from the chest into the abdomen. And that's called the hiatus. So when you have an abnormal opening in that hiatus, then you can get a hernia, and that's why they call it a hiatal hernia. And there are different grades of that. So there's been a large study, I think in the New England Journal of Medicine, that looks at management of these hiatal hernias. And one of the major symptoms is really the GERD, gastroesophageal reflux. And sometimes those patients can be on prolonged Nexium. And then that reduces their risk of getting what Dr. Rule said, Barrett's esophagus, because that's one of the risk factors. But as a hiatal hernia becomes larger or increase in the stage of it, then you may require surgical treatment. And surgical treatment is basically just to repair the mechanics of the normal mechanics. Basically bring down the organ that's up, and mostly is a part of the stomach that goes up into the chest. You pull it back down, and you sort of tighten up the hiatus so as to prevent it from going back up. That's the simplistic way of describing that. That can be done in a minimally invasive form. In doing that, you basically put back the normal barriers to this reflux of contents from the stomach into the esophagus. Because acid should not be in the esophagus. That's really toxic to the esophagus and increases your risk of getting esophageal cancer.
Okay, good evening. We have another call coming in. This is Urologist Speaks.
Hi, good evening.
Good evening. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm calling from the U.S. As a Bahamian, I must say that I've been listening for the past few weeks, and the show has really, really been extremely informative. And I'm calling in today because this one really speaks to me when you talk about the diverticulitis. I found that I had it in September and was hospitalized in December. Since then, however, well, my mom has it, and I'm doing my second colonoscopy, just preventative measures, in 2 weeks. And this will be my second one. They did remove two polyps, so it's 5 years now. But, of course, I didn't do it in January because they wanted the colon, you know, give the colon some time to, I guess, heal. But I did my physical in January, and everything was perfectly fine. Of course, my vitamin D, like everyone else. So I've been sitting in the sun every day, Monday through Friday, for about 30 minutes. I don't know the history of my father to help, but I do know that he had a heart condition. Not knowing anyone else on that side of the family as to whether or not they had colon cancer. But I've just been weeding stuff out of my diet, and I haven't really started working out yet, but I feel amazing. And I just really wanted to call and just say that I mean, it's very informative. People are living in silence, suffering in silence. I just wish that more Bahamians really would tune into the show.
Well, thank you very much your encouraging words. I'll let Dr. Gemma Roll comment.
Okay. Thank you for that call coming in from the U.S. Thank you for listening. So diverticulitis, you bring up a good point. So you were diagnosed with diverticulosis, I assume, in last year. And then by the end of the year, you had to be hospitalized for diverticulitis. So what happens, and for all the listeners out there who've had a diagnosis of diverticulitis, whether it was clinically diagnosed, confirmed by imaging, you should have a colonoscopy about 4 weeks, a month after your acute diverticulitis, because you need to be screened for colon cancer, right? So even the way that diverticulitis at times really is diagnosed, it's just a thickening of the bowel wall. So that thickening, sure, can be diverticulitis, but the goal of colonoscopy is to make sure that there isn't a colon cancer that's in this area, right? Again, if you've been diagnosed with diverticulitis or considered to have it, you should be screening for colon cancer with a colonoscopy. Thank you for bringing up that point.
We have a text, and it's asking, what is the role of using colon cleansers? Is there anything positive in using it? How often should you use colon cleansers? And what are the disadvantages or the risk of using colon cancers cleansers routinely?
So the colon is a self-cleansing organ. Our diet should afford us good bowel movements every day. Fiber supplements, if you can't eat about 30 grams of fiber from your diet every day. So colon cleansers themselves, they have some substances in colon cleansers that can do a few things to the bowel. One, it may stimulate you to have a bowel movement, and your bowel perhaps can become what we call lazy and reliant on it. Also, there is an association with melanosis coli. This is a condition where there is brown pigment depositing into the colon. So when we do a colonoscopy, inside looks like perhaps the color of your skin. It can be really dark or, you know, pigmented. This in itself is benign, but it just tells me that you're doing some extra things just to have a bowel movement. It's always good to go the natural route to have bowel movement. I probably wouldn't subscribe to the routine, regular use of these colon cleansers.
Okay, yeah. I have another question.
So we wanted to ask, because I noticed we didn't have a break, and so I guess we push it right through because we want to get all this information out. It is Colon Cancer Awareness Month, and we're talking about preventing colon cancer and the use of colonoscopy. Dr. Roll, how do I get a colonoscopy? When should I get one, and how do I get one?
You should have a colonoscopy once you are 45 years or older. You should have a colonoscopy if you are at the age of 10 years younger than your first-degree relative or two second-degree relatives with colon cancer or advanced polyps. What do I mean by that? If your father had colon cancer at 40, you should have your colonoscopy at 30. So this age should prompt you to be screened for colon cancer. We didn't talk about all the other modalities, right. But like I said, colonoscopy is the best one, hands down. You can ask somebody else about the other stuff. But yes. I mean, 45 years old, start to screen for colon cancer. Tell your doctor that you're ready to be screened.
And we want to pick this up before you have symptoms. And even if you don't have blood that is visible to the eye, you can have occult blood and you can still have colon cancer. So in any cancer, what we're trying to do is, first of all, be preventative, prevent you from ever getting the cancer. But if you do, in fact, get the cancer, we want to screen you and pick it up early where your chance of cure is almost 100%. But yes. When we talk about, as a surgical oncologist, Dr. Francis, we talk about local control for every cancer. We talk about systemic control. So local control may be surgery, for example, for a colon cancer. What's the role with systemic treatment, whether it's chemotherapy plus or minus immunotherapy?
So in colon cancer, and this is very important, chemotherapy is important in stage 3 colon cancer. And what I mean by that, that's if cancer is confined to the colon itself and not involving the lymph nodes, that would be stage 1 or stage 2, depending on the size. But when it involves the lymph nodes, it increases your risk. And with that risk, there's risk of microscopic cancers being within your blood. And then I tell people that's what chemotherapy, immunotherapy, that's what it does. It takes care of the microscopic component that my surgery can't do anything for. And that's why it's important for someone with stage 3 colon cancer to, you know, chemotherapy is important in that. That's the role of chemotherapy. If you have stage 1 or stage 2 colon cancer, just removing the colon and that's it. Nothing else is needed. You know,
and we also talk about, unfortunately, persons who overcome maybe even 20 years ago prostate cancer, or endometrial cancer, ovarian cancer, and had pelvic radiation. Unfortunately, radiation itself is a risk factor for cancer, so they can develop malignancy secondary to that treatment, particularly decades ago where there wasn't that much in the way of image guided. Yeah,
and that's pretty rare. It is, you know, that's something you read in the textbook. You know, in all of my time, I've never seen it. It's a real rare event. But I know we're about to close, and I really want Dr.
We got one more call. I don't want. Go ahead. This is Urologist Speaks.
Yes. Good evening, Dr. Pinto, Dr. Francis, and Dr. Rose.
Good evening.
I listen to this show every week.
I appreciate it.
And I called in before Dr. Pinto.
Yes, yes, I
you
remember.
You might remember.
Yeah.
My voice. But honestly, this is such an awesome show. It's an excellent show where you the information that is shared is so important, and this is what our people need. You know, we need to know what is going on. We need to pay more attention to these shows. When these shows come on, people should really listen, because I've been listening from you all started, and I mean, it's a wealth of knowledge you all have, and it's so important that people hear these things. So when, you know, something happens, they know what to do right away. Like you say, colon cancer is one of the things that could be prevented. And so I'd just like to congratulate you on this show, you know, and continue to do the great work that you're doing, because this show is so important.
Well, I thank you very much. I thank you for your kind words and your encouragement.
Yes, and you know, I've been a nurse for many years.
Yes,
so,
we all know you.
When I hear these things, I love to hear these things. Yeah. To know that knowledge is being imparted to our people so they can be more aware of what's going on with their bodies.
Yes, so we're here trying to save lives. We're trying to improve the quality of the lives of our fellow Bahamians and our residents and increase the longevity. Let's live longer and live better.
That's right. That's for sure.
So let's give Dr. Rose a last
say. Just continue the great work.
Yes, thank you very much. So let's sum it up in the last minute, Dr. Gemma Rule.
Okay, so you know, my job is always easier when a patient's physician sends them and says, oh, you need a colonoscopy, as opposed to me trying to convince them, you know, because I'm the one doing the procedure, you know. So if your doctor is a bit hesitant or has a delay in sending you for your colonoscopy, you can hit me up directly. You can WhatsApp me at 425-0440 or 827-7119. You can send me a WhatsApp. We can talk about it. We can get you set up for a colonoscopy. It's Colon Cancer Awareness Month. And I think if you put your ear to the ground, you'll know that a lot of places are giving deep discounts on getting screened for colon cancer. So make March and April your month to get it done.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Gemma Rule, for your wealth of information. Thanks again, Dr. Wesley Francis. We're going to be here next week with another informative show. I go back way back to my sister's high school years, where she was a good friend and a classmate of Dr. Gemma Rule. And my brother is a gastroenterologist. So this is also important information for me to relay to the community as a whole. So thank you very much. Have a very good evening, Bahamas, and we'll be back next week.
Take full control of your bladder. Don't let it control you. Come check with